The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It's a great pleasure to read with Larry. I'm just going to read from the beginning of the book so I don't have to explain too much. There's a book within the book, in my book, and in this opening section, the author of that book talks for a little while. So the excerpt is called, "From the Desk of Montes Crandall, Master of Fine Arts." People often ask me where I get my ideas. Or on one occasion back in 2024, I was asked, this was at a reading in an old-fashioned used media outlet right here in town, the store called Arachnids Incorporated. The audience consisted of five intrepid and stalwart folks, four out of the five, no doubt, intent on surfing aimlessly at consoles. Or perhaps they intended to leave the store when instead they were herded into a cluster of uncomfortable petrochemical multi-use furniture modules by Noel Stroop, the hard-drinking owner-operator of the shop in question. I'd been pestering Noel about a reading for some time, months, despite the fact that Arachnids was not celebrated for its calendar of arts-related programming. To be honest, the reason for this pestering had most to do with my wife, who'd spend her remaining time on Earth counseling me on just how to boost my product. "Ask Noel," my wife said, her eyes full of implacable purpose. We used to see Noel at the flea market, which by now took up more than a dozen city blocks. There were more flea markets than licensed tax-paying emporia in Rio Blanco. I had a booth there where on weekends I hawked old baseball cards and other sports memorabilia. This, therefore, is my business. It was here at the flea market, according to my wife's plans, that I screwed up my non-existent courage one Sunday and said to Noel Stroop, who was busy selling software modules, something called a compact disc, and e-book files, "Hey, Noel, what does a guy like me, a literary innovator, have to do in this town to get some respect? Perhaps you're wondering what I've done to merit such a high opinion of my legacy. What is the nature of the Montes Crandall literary innovation? I'm going to take the remainder of these notes to fully explicate my response to this question. Let me then throw down the gauntlet and remark that I, Montes Crandall, MFA, write very short, very condensed literary pieces, and by short, I mean very, very short. Shorter than you've probably read in your reading life, more than one word, usually, because one word is too easy, but quite a bit more modest than 50. The 350 pages of a novel, according to the argument I am wont to advance, are tedious elaboration. As I understand it, death, war, and adultery are the major novelistic themes, and these were all dispensed with well before Christ got nailed to his block of wood. The 19th century novel, you opine? The 19th century novel does have it all. Attic-dwelling harridans, uncanny coincidences, advantageous marriages to strong, silent landowners, orphans, revolutions, wailing. You can't go wrong with the 19th century novel, but much that has been written since amounts to imitation barely warmed over by writers with strange grammatical inclinations. Lovelorn women of Canada. incest on the southern plantation, drug using, editorial assistants. We've heard it all before. Yours truly, Montese Crandall, living out his Pacific middle age in a college town next door over to nowhere at all, is unwilling to add more roughage to this diet. One thing the late 20th century was good at, besides mass marketing, paring away, omitting needless words, alluding without overstating. Dust bunny under radiator. Cockroach on window blind. Scotch bottles. Heartbreak in the food court. Impotence, subdivisions, melanoma, muffler problems. Upon the advent of the digital age, as you know, writers who went on and on and on just didn't last. You couldn't read all that nonsense on a screen. Fragmentation became the one true way. Additionally, this strategic reduction blurred the line between poetry and prose, which is where I, Montese Crandall, come into the story. I, Montese Crandall, rely heavily on such strategies as alliteration, condensation, the strange ghostly echo of metrical feet, iambs and dactyls, spondees and amphibrax. For example, here's a pair of amphibrax, unstressed, stressed, unstressed, that might very well summarize my entire output. Romantic objective. The phrase does have a fine euphony. My first groundbreaking and innovative one-sentence story occurred in the following way. I've been working on a 45-page erotic novella that was loosely based on my boundless physical desire for my wife, Tara Schott Crandall. The sequence in which I performed a certain advanced delight upon her delicately canted pelvis ran well over 20 pages, and her mews and snorts of transport as described in the text would pierce the waxy consciousnesses of neighbors up and down the block. Her cries of delight as described therein were likened to the coyote howling on the mesa, the kettle shrilling on the stovetop. Sopranos in local opera companies would hang their heads, for they knew that when Tara Schott Crandall climaxed, they were out of a job. I am afraid that I cut the entire passage, the erotic part. And not only that, then I cut the opening and the ending. I cut a lot of the middle. I cut the part where we were post-coitally sharing a glass of Van Ordinaire. Next, I cut the astoundingly tender moment in the story where, in snappy dialogue, Tara and I revisited our assignations past, the time in the back of a minivan, the time in the woods when we got poison ivy, the time in the press box at the basketball game. For a while, a single scene remained in which the Tara character sent me out after lovemaking for eggs. Eggs. So beautiful. So fecund. Likely to balance on their oblong points during the equinoxes. Symbols of fertility. Available in multiple sizes, including jumbo. I couldn't let go of the scene for a while. You know how this is. And yet after 3 months of wrestling with that story, I cut the entire tangle of misbegotten sentences, the whole sprawling mess, or almost all of it, leaving none at last but the following. Go get some eggs, you dwarf. I don't expect everyone reading this introduction to see immediately the merit in this sentence, and yet the awakening, the unfolding that occurred to me after a relaxed consideration of the six words that remained of my longer work, this unfolding located itself in the fact that the more I read and reread the sentence above, the better I liked it. I printed it out in various fonts. I pulled my few remaining hairs out, trying to decide whether to cut the word go. I pronounced the entirety of the story aloud to myself while walking from our ramshackle subdivision to the shipping offices where I then occasionally pulled a shift. I would intone the sentence while going past the shuttered health and beauty aids purveyor on 22nd and Mountain. I would say it while taking my number at the woebegone post office on 6th. I shouted it at the beckoning doors of the gay bars on 4th Avenue. I said it to myself at the food co-op as if the eggs in question were part of my actual shopping agenda. I can't tell you how long it took me in my ecstatically creative state to realize that, in fact, there needn't be an exclamation point at the end. My wife, whose health situation had taken a rather unsettling turn, never approved of the long version of the story, though she generally supported whatever wind blew me along in my compositional hobbies. As long as I took seriously the post-compositional portion of the writer's life and got out there to sell, sell, sell. She did, however, enjoy "Go Get Some Eggs, You Dwarf." Where, my wife inquired, was I going to publish this story? Was I going to pit against one another some nationally recognized periodicals? And what about book publication? Had I considered a run of hardcovers? In fact, I had secured an agreement with a little web periodical called Mud Hut, where my story got an entire page to itself. Not 6 months later, fresh from the victory just described, I came up with what I like to think is the second finest narrative I've ever composed. And yet, before I type out for you that magnificence, I should describe what I look like, because it bears on the interpretation of this second effort. I am, you should know, in my late 40s, and it's simply being honest to note that my metabolism, which was doing wind sprints and stomach crunches throughout the dark ages of my 20s, has lately taken an ill-advised nap. I am now the site of an unmistakable sag, as if some avalanche stirred at the crest of my solar plexus and sent all the flab in my northern latitudes down toward my once noble pubic swell. With fancy holographic belt buckles do I attempt to restrain my stampeding softness in vain. Additionally, my hair is thinning, and my skin, which once had the virtue of being free from the blemishes that trouble the young, is now mottled and flaky. Burst blood vessels lead the eye of any observer astray around my nose. I am yoked to bifocals for my ocular needs. I have fallen arches, hammer toes. My only virtues as a physical specimen are my sideburns, which are like the pelts of a rare woodland animal. My sideburns are not to be ignored. No one, let it be said, would mistake me for a pugilist, for a law and order type of guy, for a person drawn to physical conflicts, for a militarist. I do not carry a taser or other weapon loaded or unloaded, though this is legal and even encouraged in my state. However, I could easily write at least 5 pages about these sorts of weapons, the Gatling, the Armalite, the Glock, the Proton Disruptor, revealing a complex and deeply seated need for the appurtenances of male power and phallic supremacy, even as I disdain these commonplaces in my everyday life and incline, in an era of Islamist saber-rattling, toward a foreign policy of tolerance. non-violence and non-intervention. And yet, as you will have surmised at this point, the 5 pages of such an essay would sooner or later be stripped of elaborations, adjectives, adverbs, similes, astute geopolitical views, until what remained was only, "We went with the stealth bomber." This was a sentence of such limpid beauty and such durability that it was difficult to follow up, notwithstanding an unprecedented second publication on the Mud Hut site. So affecting was the sentence, in fact, that there was a danger in having composed it, namely that I would retreat to the reliable paycheck of some day job, becoming, for example, an exclusive buyer and seller of baseball cards and sports memorabilia without composing again. I don't know how many months went by. During this time, my argument was simply, why bother? Have I not already proven myself? Have I not written a timeless epic from the front lines of the military-industrial complex, which in the third decade of the new millennium we now know to be not only a complex, but more or less the entire shebang? The answer was yes. There was no longer a need to prove my dominance in the writing field. In fact, what I craved instead, here at the top of my game, was domesticity. The ability to control a little narrow patch of scorpion and tarantula-infested dry land around a single-story house in a town where it never rained. Yet professionalism being what it is, in due course a suite of stories in the first person followed. Apparently, I could not stop. In general, I prefer a narration from the third-person point of view. The first person is tiresome and confining. It is the voice of narcissists and borderline personalities. Still, my wife, whose problem was a respiratory problem, was getting worse. She was fast approaching her double lung transplant, and it would have been easy just to wait around until her name came up on the International Organ Lottery. While it would have been easy to collect the meager government funds disbursed to her as a citizen with a chronic genetic condition, I did, in fact, need some avenue of self-expression. Along came the idea for my masterful trilogy, if you like. If it helps you to understand the kinds of influences that resulted in the literary coming of age of Montese Crandall, you may think of these next 3 stories as thematically related to the 3-volume compositions of the 19th century, not unlike A Doorstopper by Thackeray or Trollope. Well, actually, on advice of counsel and in order to avoid violating my own copyright with regard to a future collected works of Montese Crandall presently being discussed at one of the larger presses, I'm advised to forego quotation of these works from the middle period. I'm sure you understand. Perhaps at some future date I will oblige. Years had passed in my writerly biography, it seemed to me, years of dreams and ambitions. Years of seeing other less equipped artists finding publication, even renown, in web publishing venues or even small press publication, while I had as yet completed only 5 publishable sentences, notwithstanding my education at a state school in the Northeast and a Master of Fine Arts degree from an online program in the Rust Belt. As a result, I was in no position to suppress my trilogy or to recall its publication, which constituted a full 60% of my output. Not every work by a writer is his best, especially when he's preoccupied with more homely responsibilities, one of these being the resale of baseball cards obtained from the disgruntled mothers of the world, who, as you know, have forged an international conspiracy to throw out the baseball cards in order to drive up prices. My other activity consisted of lugging oxygen tanks around my house. There was also the vigorous pounding on the back of my wife, Tara, which was occasionally necessary in the mornings so that she could take advantage of life. I loved my wife. I comforted her when she needed comforting. My wife, understand, was going to die, and she knew it, and I knew it, and now you know it too. When the breeze blew up across the waterless tundra of my state, I often thought, if only I could just harness some of that breeze and give it to Tara, our problems would be resolved. There are no sailboats in my part of the country that need the breezes. The jet pilots would be happy to encounter less clear air turbulence. The state officials have resisted wind farms at every turn. And the earthly atmosphere that shrink wraps the globe offers a rich supply of oxygen. Why couldn't my wife Tara have a bit of it in her bloodstream? What made her so undeserving? With this going on, you see, I sometimes didn't feel much like writing. Thanks a lot.
Evening. Thank you for having me here. I too am going to read a bit from the beginning by way of introduction, and then I'll read a good part. She screams as if that will help. Interior high school hallway night. In black and white, not art. A hot smudge of blind whites and ash blacks. This is the sorry noir of drive-in horror shows, the dreams of dogs and monsters. Enter right, screaming, the girl, in high distress and heels. She takes the corner wide, skips and skids into the lockers with metallic wallop, ricochets and goes splat, displayed. In such a lovely and hideous dress. The girl crawls for traction on the cold wax floor. Her nails shouldn't shatter like that. She could use more zinc in her diet or less stress. And here it comes into the light, close on, the creature. Cranial sac engorged, strange fluids athrob, the lobes beneath its diaphanous skull crackling with spidery fire. Its big cat eyes loom with lust or thirst, or the first to be followed by the second. As the creature reaches for her, its middle digit extends telescopically and impressively. The tip quivers along her pristine cheek, leaving an appropriate residue. She screams again, her face meant to convey a complex interplay of terror and desire, which is not coming across at all. The creature's features collapse. Its feelings are hurt. She kicks off her heels, clever girl, and is up on stockings, slipping away, still screaming, night after night after night after night. She should know by now that nobody's coming. A bit of a jumble next, an editor's breakfast of switch bands, smash cuts, meant to scare and disguise the lack of a usable master. The girl's wide eye, a blur of wall, the creature's dripping mouth, her frenzied rear end, assorted lights, some creature part, a flash of stock lightning ending on her pretty untorn face, eyes darting, seeking, at last finding room 51. The girl struggles with the knob. The creature is gangling up on her. Of course she screams, a terrible use of her limited time. The creature reaches for her with erectile fingers. The door is jarred loose by narrative imperative, and she exits, slamming. Interior high school, room 51 day. The creature throws open the door. It recoils. The classroom is filled with human adolescents, taking a test. Their instructor, Dr. Rand, glances up from his desk. Dr. Rand, Jim, have you forgotten our exam this morning? The creature is horror-struck. Human adolescent male. That's not the only thing he forgot. As one, the class looks down. The creature looks down and sees that it is naked. The humans laugh. The creature cannot hide its shortcomings fast or well enough. The humans giggle maniacally. This blends into a kicky 12-string guitar ostinato, and they begin to sing. And fortunately for you, I will not be singing this. It's the end of the summer. We're having a blast. They nuke the oceans. Beaches turn into glass. and we're out of our little film, to his lids opened vertically, then horizontally, unveiling eyes many shades bluer than his skin. Jim Anderson lay in bed contemplating another day, another dollar, as a teenage alien on planet Earth. Inside the orb at his bedside, Brian Wilson sang, and I could probably sing this the way Brian Wilson would sing it now, but I won't. It's the end of the summer. Here comes the hard rain. They nuke the oceans. The waves are insane. The boy's face wasn't half so monstrous in color. His dusky blue-gray skin muted the ridges and spurs protruding here and there in patterns beautiful only to mathematicians, and his features were humanoid, if a little more oily in spots. His eyes were ultramarine, deep seas of whatever one wished to believe they were deep seas of, and kept in perpetual squint, which reduced their disturbing circumferences and made intimations of soul. Delicate respiratory slits suggested a vestigial cute nose, and his pouty lips were possibly kissable, if situated on another head, and not periwinkle. His ears were independently rotational and highly emotional. His forehead was quite high, approximately 10 inches, and bulging with brains. But even this evoked the slicked, upswept hairstyle favored by singers and delinquents, without the hair. A girl with enough imagination might have found him attractive in a rugged, sun-dried sort of way. The girls at Jim's school did not possess that much imagination. Not just the end of the summer, looks like the end of the world. Jim sat at the edge of the bed, the great mass of his head bowing his spine into a posture most adolescent males assume voluntarily. This kyphosis, though mechanical, neatly expressed his ineffable burden, the worldview he carried on his shoulders. Armageddon's a bummer, looks like the end of the world. The singer faded from the orb, replaced by the K-bomb logo, which fissioned, leaving behind a pair of piggy green eyes stuck in a slab of green fat. Shiny, the eye squealed. That was an H blast from the past from the rays. And this is, with maximum reverb, Marshall the Martian. In the morning, the Martianet sang, to which the orb jockey appended his catch ejaculation. Neat, neat. Jim squinted his first hate of the day. He stood. Crick. Jim's nasal slits rippled. His day was about to become 50% more self-loathsome. He was alone, a small comfort. It could have happened later at school in gym, and that would be fun, or the cafeteria like last spring when Sally Fraser screamed and vomited on Hazel Court, triggering a chain regurgitation that got lasagna removed from the lunch menu permanently. I thought for a long time of what they would be eating at lunch that would be disgusting enough it was thrown up multiple times in succession. I think lasagna was really the perfect choice. Best to get it over with. Jim twisted his neck down and to the right. The seam between his cerebral hemispheres ruptured, revealing his neck skin, silvery cyan, bright and shiny, unmissable. His before skin retracted with a viscous crinkle, peeling back over two glistening humps of cerebrum, blatant beneath the fresh membrane that clung to every nook and sulcus. All his thoughts were on public view, synaptic bursts twinkling across his cranium, the area currently most active being his basal ganglia or profanity center. His dead face fell away, leaving one that only wished it was, coated with a clear oil similar to petroleum jelly but highly reflective and 30 times as aromatic. It did not wash, wipe, rub, scrape, scrub, or boil off. Gradually, it would work into his new skin, darkening and dimming it to the pleathery exterior Jim could almost abide. But until then, Jim would be the greasy kid, subject to the customary names and jocularities, offering sweet respite to Bobby Harvey, an oil-producing human who was said to give girls blackheads simply by staring at them. The molt moved on, shuddering over Jim's sloped shoulders and sloughing off his sinewy arms, crawling down his angular, occasionally pointed torso, down his long legs and pooling in underpants at his feet. Jim kicked off his old skin. It skittered under the bed. Shit, Jim thought, meaning himself, and began his morning shuffle, Teen Beach slouching towards Armageddon, another day strewn with the idiocies and indignities he lived for, the petty evidence that he was right and they were human. Jim has some other problems other than the fact that his skin just all came off and now he's like basically one giant zit, which makes a person feel self-conscious. He catches a lot of light with this thing in his skin. He also has the problem that his father killed 300 million people and so he's sort of like, it would be like if you were in class and they would be taking attendance, it says Bob Hitler, and you go, So that's kind of what he has to live with. And he also has this friend, Marie, who's a human. Her mother happens to be a head in a pan, but she's human. And he's been her friend ever since she was a kid, and he wants to step it up to the next step. And that's always very difficult, to take someone who's always been your friend and try to turn it the other way. And he's been trying to ask her to this dance and sort of chickening out. And this is really his last chance, because she's about to take a sex education class from which she will never return. So he's at the door. Marie, Jim said at a volume he calibrated to be heard by her and no one else. She turned and smiled. Jim leaned forward and into a bright green reptorial foreleg. The pincher tugged his earlobe, its spiked tibia grazing his throat. A triangular head appeared from above, a woman's face etched in exoskeleton, her antenna twitching impatiently. "Shoo!" Miss Manta said. That's a Greek accent. When you hear that again, that's Greek. Malia Mantis had been teaching feminine hygiene at Manhattan High School for a dozen years since the accident. To look at her, her lime hair and shellac buns at the corners of her head, her prothorax, nothing to write home about, it was hard to imagine she had once been Miss Greece, a Jill of the Month and a promising sex researcher. Had she isolated that pheromone that drives male mantids so wild they don't mind getting their heads bitten off, she'd be queen of the earth. Instead, she was a 9-foot-tall predatory insect with an enormous caboose, things sometimes turning out differently than one imagines they will. Miss Mantis loved her girls, though, she often said, while despising them. "Ladies," she addressed with a sensuous Grecian hiss, "shut it up now." That's kind of more Eastern Europe than Greek, but it's Greek. The whispering and tittering came to an abrupt halt. Miss Mantis clicked across the room and crawled onto a tree trunk that served as her desk. "So," she said, "who are we going to the dance hop tomorrow night?" That's Russian, really, I guess. Maybe I'll just change her name and just make her Russian. After a pause for translation, all the girls raised their hands except Marie. Sandra Jane kicked at her, but Marie shook her head. Sandra Jane is Marie's human friend, sort of human. Her mother is the 50-foot woman. Her father's the incredible shrinking man, and so she's been trying to pass. And the last thing she wants is to be hanging out with Jim, who's an alien in that particular case. So she's trying to tell Marie to stay away from Jim. "It is time," Miss Mantis tented her forelegs, "for you ladies to see the sex fees." There was much unladylike excitement. Her spiracles at full blast brought about order. "It is not for giggling," Miss Mantis said. And then we have a scene in a gym with dodgeball, which is boring. So we're going to skip right to the sex. "Strange Desires," the title promised, and the dark room tingled with the nervous yearning of 18 adolescent human females desirous of desire. Marie alone took notes. The viz was at least 10 years old, judging from the subtly ridiculous hair and clothes, with odd scratches on the image. But what it lacked in contemporary setting, good writing, credible acting, adequate lighting, and any camera work at all, it made up for it in being about sex. In the hallway of a high school much like their own, Molly, a pretty brunette, was talking excitedly to Peggy, an equally pretty blonde. "And after the dance, we went up to Lookout Point." "You went up to Lookout Point with Archie?" "Sure, silly." Peggy gasped. "But he's a cucarachan." "It was fun," Molly said. "But you have to watch out for that second set of arms." The two girls laughed. Molly fainted. The scene switched to a doctor's office. Molly sat in a gown on an examination table, attended by kindly Dr. Kinsey, who Marie recognized from an ad viz for the Frost Chief, the home head freezer. Molly was distraught. "How can I be pregnant? We only kissed." "Molly," Dr. Kinsey patiently explained, "for your friend Archie, kissing is a form of mating. And now I'm afraid he's laid eggs in your brain." "Oh, no." Dr. Kinsey placed a reassuring hand on Molly's knee, chuckling softly. "Oh, no is right." Then with a pat above the knee, "But that's the risk you girls take when you get into sexual shenanigans with alien species." Marie stopped writing. She could not understand how identical information could have come from an approved educational viz and Sandra Jane Douglas. Dr. Kinsey gave Molly a comforting squeeze a few inches higher on the leg and walked over to a file cabinet, a metal device once used to store paper documents. He removed a manila folder, like a Plex folio, only with mass. "Here, let me show you some disturbing photographs." The girls in Miss Mantis' class, based on the sounds they were making, did not want to see disturbing photographs, yet they could not look away, especially Marie. Dodgeball, dodgeball. Okay. Some of the girls were crying. Some of them were actually sketching the disturbing photographs in the viz, impatient for the bell, so that they could run to the bathroom and compare what they drew with what was spreading on their thighs. Marie was thinking about what Sandra Jane had told her, and about Jim, and what kind of person she was, and what on earth was that? Dr. Kinsey shut the manila folder, and that was from over the sweater. Gee, Dr. Kinsey, Molly said, I never knew that dating outside my species could be so dangerous. Dangerous, the doctor agreed, and disgusting. He smiled indulgently at her, since it was her line. Oh, Molly said, but what about these eggs in my brain? Dr. Kinsey scribbled on a pad of paper. I'm writing you a prescription for a DDT inhaler. Two sprays, day and night, for 10 days ought to take care of those buggers. He placed the prescription in her palm and cupped both of her hands around it. Thank you, doctor. Dr. Kinsey peered down over his glasses. Now, what are you going to do the next time an extraterrestrial asks you out? Molly was unsure. Stay home and take care of it myself? Good girl. They laughed. She tried to tug her hand away, but he clasped it more firmly, laughing for longer than she did. The lights came up. Sandra Jane eyebrowed Marie, who, with a small dip of her head, betrayed Jim. So, Miss Mantis demanded, what are the questions? The girls had a lot of questions. They did not ask any of them. Yes, Miss Mantis, I have a question, Sandra Jane said, in that wholesome voice she found so amusing. I know it's unhealthy and wrong to have shenanigans with aliens. Yes, Miss Mantis said, and the mutants, and the robots. But does that mean, she said, drawing the trap, that it's okay to do that with human boys? Miss Mantis did not fluster. It is tedious, she answered, but not as bad. Just want to point out that the only laughs I ever get on the DDT line are sort of more mature kind of voices. I guess everybody under the age of, say, 30 doesn't know what DDT was, right? But anyway.
We're supposed to police this part ourselves.
Okay. Well, all these people have wonderful questions, so.
You'll see some people coming down with microphones. Any questions? Larry's really funny, so if you ask a question, he'll be prepared to answer it in an amusing way, perhaps.
I wanted to say that the last time I read after somebody, it was a couple of weeks ago, at the and I'm just talking until you people talk, so was at this Portland Writers Conference, and we were in this giant auditorium, and Anne Hood read right before me. And Anne Hood's a wonderful writer, but she read this essay that she wrote for the New York Times about her child who had died at the age of 6. And she went into extreme detail of being in the emergency room and her child's last words, which were mama. And everyone was crying. And then as she got off stage, she was hugged by the head of the conference. And he said, and now Larry Doyle. So
I was going to read the dying child section of my book, but I swear.
While that was an intimidating thing that Mr. Moody read before, at least it was somewhat more approachable from.
For God's sake, someone raise your hand.
My question is for Rick. I wondered, given that your book is very long and there's this whole thing about Montes writing these very short sentences, if sort of through writing about his cutting process, you were ever tempted to cut down the size of your novel.
Well, it's possible that Montes will still cut this book down to the one sentence. And in fact, I've selected the sentence. Would you like to know what it is? The sentence is, you know, I'm very fond of you. So if you wanted to know what the entire book is about in one sentence, there it is. For God's sakes, someone raise your
hand. I have a question. Why have you reversed the book jacket?
Because this is the book. When I go out on the road, I take out a copy of my book that I have people in the audience sign, everyone in the audience sign. In fact, you'll be asked to sign this book.
And so that's why you reverse it, so that people can...
So that I don't confuse it with other books, yeah. Larry, how did you get your start?
I'm glad you're going to ask me where my ideas
come
from.
Where do you get your ideas?
There's a store that only writers know about.
The idea store. That's right. I've been there, too. I go and they have the sale.
They have great ideas. I'll answer another question you didn't ask, was how do you get a job on The Simpsons? Because that's the other question I get asked.
Yeah, how do you get a job on The Simpsons?
You get an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, and you say, Matt sent me. And it needs to be in block letters, no more than an inch high. And you fold it lengthwise. And then you go to the gates at Fox, which is at 11201. You can find it. It's in Los Angeles. You slip it under the gate. And after about a minute, the gates will open, and then you'll be working on The Simpsons.
There it is. Have you ever met any of The Simpsons?
We had to watch some of the actors from The Simpsons wear those giant suits once. They had to go to some event where they had to wear the giant suits, and they're all getting a little older now.
Yeah.
And so being inside a 150-degree suit is just not the kind of thing you want to be doing at age 50. I think Harry was like 60 or something. And they were not very happy. But then now they're getting $300,000 an episode, so
yeah.
They're happier.
They're plenty happy. Any other questions?
Can I ask you a potentially scary question about books being turned into films? Is it as awful an experience being an author and watching someone else kind of take that from you? Since you both have that experience, can you talk about it a little bit?
His book was a good film. I think that's a little bit... I assume you like Ice Storm.
Yeah, my experience was really great. I've had other experiences since then of the straight-to-video variety, which were not as good. I think you only get to have the great experience once, if you're lucky.
My experience on the one you're talking about, I Love You, Beth Cooper, which you don't need to hear it from me, since 93% of the critics agreed, didn't turn out that great, was, however, a very pleasant experience. It was really nice. Chris Columbus, great guy, great to talk to. He always listened to me. Movie didn't turn out as well as I would have liked. So I don't know that necessarily, and I've been on other movies where they were incredibly horrible experiences, and those movies also turned out terribly. So I'm not really sure there's a rule there to learn.
I mean, here's the area where we might discuss between the two of us briefly. My sense was that I would have been... The only way I could be really miserable about the experience was to believe that I, in fact, had any impact on it. So I went into the experience understanding that I was going to have absolutely no impact, that on the totem pole of people relating to the film, I was somewhere after the union guys, and there was not going to be a moment when my opinion was worth, you know, anything. And as a result, I was never unhappy because I expected nothing less.
That's a completely accurate description of the writer in Hollywood in terms of... And it's even more than that, that not only would your opinion not counted for anything, it would have had a negative impact, that it would have been suspect because it was your opinion, that as the writer of the material, you couldn't possibly understand it. This sounds like a joke, I know, but completely true. And just one... short anecdote. This happened to me twice, but I'll tell the second one because it's, it has better visuals. On I Love You, Beth Cooper, based on a book that had done reasonably well, and so I was flown up to Vancouver to go visit the set, and it was only because of my great relationship with the director that I was actually able to visit the set. A lot of times the writers aren't even allowed on the set, or maybe it's like one day, or I was there for 2 weeks. So I get to the set, and I go up, and there's this nice gentleman standing behind a desk in front of a 10-foot-tall poster of the cover of the book. And I say, hi, I'm here to see Michael Barnathan. And he says, and you are? And I say, and I'm Larry Doyle. And he's like, and you're here because I wrote the book. Do you have an appointment? You know, and in Hollywood, by the way, this, I don't know, even know what they would do with the authors. I guess they treat the authors much, an author of a book, they treat them very nicely for the one day they had to deal with them, and then they would get rid of them. But the writers of the movies, they don't even treat that well. And for example, there's a list of everyone. It's called the call sheet. Everyone that works on the movie, and I mean everyone, including the person who gets the water for the caterer. The writer's name is not on that list. And almost never is. Because the director doesn't want anyone calling the writer and asking the writer a question.
There's a hand back there. Maybe we should take... There are actually two hands. It's incredible.
Hi. My question is for Rick, and it's about the Twitter story that you did a couple months ago. And are there any plans to do anything like that again, or how did you feel about the reaction to that?
For those who aren't up to speed technologically, I wrote a short story that was published on the Twitter website. As you might have heard, all Twitter posts have to be 140 characters or less. So this story was made out of 153 sections of 140 characters or less and was published on Twitter, one section every 10 minutes, 8 hours a day for 3 days. It took 3 days for it to run. And at the conclusion of that, I was vilified, mainly by sort of book blogger types, because it's way too tedious to go into. I actually feel really good about the piece. I think it was a great piece to write, and I loved typing in the 140 character counting box. I just loved it. In fact, someone asked me to write a little piece about my experience writing the Twitter story, and I immediately went back to the character counting box and wrote the whole piece in the character counting box. But that said, I just think Twitter is worthless. I think it's the ultimate navel-gazing technology. And leaving aside its applications in Iran and Palestine, which I think are indisputably important, it seems to be really of no great interest in the United States. It's a press release vehicle, really, you know? It's like for basketball players to talk about how many points they scored or something. I don't know. It's not...
Or what you're having for lunch.
What you're having for lunch, yeah.
Well, I have a question for you, because I've tried to do like a narrative, not a whole story, but just things that link together. And it seems to me the problem with the technology, aside from the fact that it's just so ephemeral, is if you post something 10 minutes and then 10 minutes go by, people aren't paying that. They're not sitting there reading their Twitter feed.
Yeah.
You know, so they're not able to connect one thing to the next. And if you have something that's in the middle of a story, that might be the first one of the seven that they saw.
Indeed. Plus it loads backwards. So you essentially have to read backwards up your screen to read the entire story. It was ineffective in some ways. I think what we learned was that Twitter is not a great publishing vehicle for literary fiction. But it made a really good story, and I then published the story in this magazine, Electric Literature, who were the sponsors of the piece in the first place. It looks great on the page, and I've read it in public many times now, and it's great. It's a great reading piece. So I actually think the story came out fine, but Twitter is just hard to deal with. Do you do it regularly? Are you
supposed to?
Yeah. Is that one of the things your publishers ask
you? Yeah, telling you to do. And I try to disguise just the bald promotional aspects of everything I do. Like every once in a while, I'll do a couple of runs that don't have anything to do with anything, or you know, or just try to make a joke about it. But it is sort of worthless. And not only is it worthless as a communication device, but it seems to be worthless as a promotional device too.
Yeah. I think that's right. That supposedly the users are the...
How many people here came today because of the 9 times I Twittered about it? And it was retweeted, too, by the way. It wasn't just to my followers.
I think if people were really honest on Twitter, every single tweet would say, I am writing a tweet.
They'd have to reduce that to one symbol, though, because that's like 20 of their
too
characters.
Long. Too many characters. Wait, you had a question here, right?
You kind of just said that the films made was a pleasant experience, but they were two really very unusual, very good films, and particularly The Ice Storm, that was, I think it was Ang Lee's first film.
No, but third.
His third, oh, it was,
yes.
After those Eat, Drink, and All
those. Yeah, yeah.
But it was his first American film, where he's kind of
his first studio project, yeah.
And it was very, very highly regarded, and when you say it was a pleasant experience, could you elaborate a little bit on that? And also Garden State 2, which was kind of a cult film, but it was a wonderful film.
Not my book. Just
no?
Stole the title. Yeah, really? Garden State doesn't have anything to do with me, although if I met Zach Braff, I would try to strangle him.
Oh, okay. Okay, but how about Ice Storm then?
I mean, it was a great experience. I admired Aang already at that time. I saw Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, and Wedding Banquet before they made The Ice Storm, and I thought they were great films. And my feeling was, I mean, this was the film was optioned in 1995, so that's a long time ago in sort of cultural history now, because it was a period where independent cinema really meant something. And my feeling was, if anyone was going to adapt well what I had done or in a way that would interest me, it would have to be an independent filmmaker. I just had no faith that the studios would be up to the task at all. So I was very excited to learn that Aang was interested. I sort of felt like The Ice Storm was the exact same film as Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, which is about an absent father and the family's concern with sort of the lack of patriarchy in their family, and that's exactly what The Ice Storm is about. So I figure all he did was update themes that were of interest to him and set it someplace that was a little more American than what he had done before, you know. So all of that meant that sort of walking through the process and seeing it happen from the perspective of the filmmaker himself was, exciting, interesting, a life changer in some ways. But all the ancillary stuff that has to do with the studio and studio politics and how they roll out the film and all the publicity and all that stuff, that's harder to take. So there are ways that the process, no matter how you slice it, even if it's a really great, felicitous, artistic experience, just kind of makes you feel like a cog in the machine a little bit. I mean, that's just how it came out. Like, how many times did I have to see the words Ang Lee's The Ice Storm, you know, right and left in every magazine that I opened at that time, you know, which didn't make me feel bad because I knew to expect it, but it just got sort of, the characters who I labored on with such difficulty were sort of stripped away from me, and that's what happened. I mean, the good news is the book survived. People are still reading it, and it helped me to have a career I might not have had otherwise. Those are all good things. But at the
movie must have sold books, right?
Yeah, it totally sold books, yeah. I sold a lot of books after the movie came out. But it's regrettable to me that we live in a literary environment where the only way you can really make a career as a writer is eventually to have that big hulking billboard of cinema sell your books for you. Okay.
Thanks. I have actually two questions. One, how much longer will publishing actually last? How much longer will we be reading books in hardcover, paperback, and so forth? And then two, how much longer will the MFA boom last also? Are we at the high water mark for MFAs? Is it excessive at this point, et cetera, et cetera?
Do you want to tackle the publishing industry one, and tackle the MFA?
I'm sort of optimistic about publishing. It's sort of like what you consider publishing. I don't consider an electronic book different from a book. I'm going to keep reading books in physical form because that's what I like to do, but I don't have any issues other than piracy, say, with electronic forms of book. It's still words. It's still being received into the eye and being imagined. So if your question is how long will physical books be around, I don't know, probably for a while, for at least 10 years, but maybe not after that. But books and novels themselves, I think, will continue indefinitely.
I'm sort of even more hopeful about physical books than Larry is. I kind of think, my guess is that younger people like them more than we think they do, and that sort of telling them that all the reading is going to be on a computer-like object is not necessarily what they want to hear. And I kind of think the hardcore literary audience is like Charlton Heston and his weapons. So I sort of feel, at least for me, and I have a Kindle. Someone gave me, I got a Kindle for Christmas last year, and I read exactly one book on it, and then I was seduced back to the big pile of physical books, and now the Kindle is a dusty thing. So I sort of feel, at least for me, you know, freeing myself from prejudice to a degree, I can nonetheless say that I'm so attached to the actual old-fashioned version that I can't imagine giving it up unless someone makes me, you know. And on the MFA front, I would say it's so in the university's best interest to keep those programs going because they're cash cows. They totally are. The overhead is a copying machine. Most of the writers want to be adjuncts because they would rather write than teach full time. So it's great. Like, unlike a medical program or an engineering program, you don't need any money to fund one. It's cheap. And I went to Columbia, and there wasn't very much fellowship money there, so that was, you know, profit, profit, profit. Columbia will never let go of that department as long as it's viable, as long as they have enrollment. But that's a really bad question to end on. Someone ask a happy question, then we'll stop. I guess not. Ma'am.
For both of you, who has influenced your writing, and who do you like to read now? Who?
I don't read just one author. I always try to give recommendations. I have, unfortunately, the same favorites as everybody does, and so I don't want to go through any of those. And so I'll just recommend people, like if you want to read a really funny book and not about mutants, I would recommend Charles Portis's Dog of the South, which is probably one of the funniest comic novels ever written. I think it's from about 30 years ago. So, I read all the people everybody else reads.
Really? Like who? Who does everyone else read?
Vonnegut, say.
I think probably no one in this room except me reads Vonnegut. Is there anyone in this room who regularly reads Kurt Vonnegut?
Or has read Kurt Vonnegut? Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I mean...
Yeah, but you read it. You read him in the 70s. Did anyone
right.
read
no,
him?
No, I mean read.
Did anyone
no, I,
read him since George Bush was president? Yes? Really? That's incredible. All right, who else?
You.
I'm touched that you would say everyone
I'm reading
reads
your
me.
Book now. Pinchon. I have a science degree, so I didn't read in college, so I'm always going back and having to go back and read things that I never read. Like, I've only read a couple of Faulkner books, and so I've got to go read all of those and, you know, that kind of thing. But, the people I like are Donald Bartlemy, Kurt Vonnegut. He sort of has disappeared, strangely enough.
Well, that's a really interesting story.
And you were mentioning Brodigan earlier. Yeah. He's another guy who sort of seems to have vanished.
Yeah.
It was a great writer.
But I think with Barthelme, that's great because people can rediscover him later, mm-hmm. and he's so amazing. He'll be worth it. It's interesting. Someone just sent me that Dog of the South book, and I haven't read it yet, but now I'm excited to read it. I'll just recommend my favorite book of recent years, and that's The Rings of Saturn by W.G. Zabald, who wrote Austerlitz. It's an amazing book, very strange, really beautifully written, a must read, in my opinion. Uncle.
Folks, you can join us upstairs in the lobby where the authors will be signing copies of their book in just a couple minutes.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.